Hello and welcome to The Family of Things, a podcast series exploring ideas, life, and how we live it. I'm Helen Shaw, and my guest this week is Dr. Shane Bergen, a scientist who says his mission is to share and communicate the beauty of physics. Now, Shane, as a physicist, I know you work in the field of new materials in nanotechnology, which is defining our future. But I'm curious about the beginning, about young Shane and how it all started. Were you always the inventor conducting home experiments as a child? I mean, what was on your Santa list?
Lego was the thing that I loved as a child. But you hit the nail on the head when you said inventor. I remember as a very young child playing with Lego, and I'd be building things, and my dad or my mum would ask me, what would you like to do when you're older? And I'd always say inventor. And I think that came from many places. My granddad, when he worked, he was a mechanic, and he mended tanks on the Curragh camp. And so he was very inventive in the way he'd approach things. And I spent a lot of time with him. My dad, too, is a scientist, albeit a biologist. So I spent a lot of time in the lab with him. As a child, I remember standing up on stools and playing with things where appropriate. And that really encouraged me to explore and to think about things and to try and understand the world and just to play with things. So I also, from my grandmother and my mother, spent a lot of time in the kitchen with them, baking and playing with stuff there. And I think there's a huge amount of inventiveness involved in those pursuits too.
Because you're a good cook, huh?
Yeah, I love to cook. I find it very relaxing to come home in the evening and spend an hour cooking.
That's it. I mean, children don't see lines between music and sport and playing and building, cooking. They don't see the barriers that sometimes we've put it into in society, that some things are in the arts and some things are in science, and that some things are seen as soft or hard. I mean, I go as far back in school that I remember in my school, the head nun, and there was a nun then, saying when we got to the choice part in secondary, that it was either science or domestic science.
Yeah, when you go to school, the barriers between subjects were put up so soon after entering into education. And I think that's unnecessary. Like the skill of being verbal and being communicative, things that we'd associate with writing and English, they're essential if you want to be a scientist, because communication is at the heart of science. Similarly, mathematics is very important for music. Symmetry is important in drawing. I could go on. So there's all of these things. And what we need to see is that we want to create an environment where people can be allowed to sort of develop their own potential. And that might be a very unusual mix of subjects that to that nun that you went to in school would be completely sort of, no, you can't do that. It doesn't fit with the timetable. So I think like the likes of junior cycle reform at the moment, where we're moving away from these rigidly held subjects that are tested once at the end of 3 years to a system where people are being asked to think about skills that they might need as opposed to subjects they might need to master. I think that's an excellent development.
Because in many ways, we live in a society which has tended to not just draw a line, but to separate the sciences and the arts.
I think it was it Goethe or maybe Thomas Jung were said to be the last people who knew everything. But since the scientific process, the modern sense of the scientific process has been established in, when I guess, the 1600s, the amount of knowledge in the world has grown exponentially. So it becomes increasingly difficult for any one individual to know everything. But that's what people think of science. They think it's something like it's a rigid, dead body of fact, as in you can just rhyme them off, all these laws and equations. But that's not really what science is. Science is much more creative. Science is about you manipulating and understanding your world such that you can do different things or do new things, create. Just like Matisse would have looked at art from a radically different point of view. I would hope that young scientists and maybe old scientists would do that too in their careers, that they would imagine and then go and test, then explore what that result means and bring knowledge forward.
And in some ways then it makes you see that the similarities between the artist, the visual artist, the writer, is much closer to the scientist, and they should be seen maybe in much more of a collaborative shape, because to do really original work, you have to be a bit of an outsider. You have to actually look at the rules and say, is that really so?
Absolutely. You need to, I hate to use the cliche, but you need to think outside the box. Rather than sort of tweak existing systems, you need to imagine an entirely radical new system and allow your mind to explore what that might mean. It's that intellectual pursuit that you must explore. And you're right to say that science and art are almost the opposite side of the same creative coin. And you can see places in Dublin where we're particularly good at this. Dublin's small, so it allows the science community to get up close and personal with the arts community. You can see, of course, the Dublin Science Gallery, which was a world first of colliding science with art in a very radical way to get them both to talk to one another. So it wasn't that the artists were just helping out with how we present science or vice versa, but rather it was what happens when you smash these two seemingly disparate worlds together. What happens when you put creative people in from different disciplines in the same space? What will they create? And that's been amazing. It's been amazing from my own career's point of view too, to be part of that. So for instance, I think that a lot of people would see science as something that's ugly. They see it as necessary. People see science as something that drives economy and creates jobs. Indeed, our own government do. But there's more to it than that. I think science is beautiful. And people go, of course you do, you're a scientist. But I think there is a beauty, an inherent beauty to science, a simplicity often, an elegance that can be captured by working with people from the arts who are skillful at bringing that out. And so through the Science Gallery, starting there, working with colleagues in Trinity, Professor Colette Murphy and Dr. Evie Nihulawan, now in UCD, we created this campaign in Dublin called Dart of Physics. And that stemmed from this project in the Science Gallery. And from that, we were able to design and execute a huge campaign across Dublin on the Dart train to spark a citywide conversation about physics.
It's been really successful. You've won an award for it.
Yeah, I have. I won another one just recently. So I won a European Commission Award for Communicating Science. And just last week, I found out I won the American Association for the Advancement of Science Communication Award.
So my colleagues
have been, thank you. My colleagues have been busy nominating me.
And just to describe how it works, Shane, because I think you're also going to look at expanding that idea of the Dart of Physics again. But just to explain how it worked, you were using smartphones with commuters?
So we took the advertising space on the Dart. You know, the ads that are above the seats when you sit there, or you're, well, let's face it, you're standing on the Dart on your way to work, and you notice there are lots of advertisements. They're also on the station. So we decided that why not fill some of these with statements and challenges about physics? Very simple things like the spire is shorter on a cold winter's day than it is in the summer. Or you could say, why does the metal pole feel colder than the plastic seat, etc., etc. Things like this, or something profound like the moon is escaping the earth, or we are all made of stardust. So these, yeah, which is an amazing sentiment.
I like that
sentiment.
One. We're all made of stardust.
Absolutely. So when
I am a dead star.
You are. You're a part of the stardust that came from that star's death. And that's amazing. And the hydrogen in your body would have come from the Big Bang. And that's 13.8 billion years ago. And so we have this cosmic connection. Of course, everything else around us, all matter is made from elements of atoms. And they would have all come from either dead stars or the Big Bang. And so there's this continuity in the universe, which I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, that idea of bringing science into the public space is fantastic. But what did you really want to get out of it in the end?
We wanted to connect the Joe on the Dart to the Josephine in the lab. That was one of our taglines, because we wanted to spark this citywide conversation. Rather than us just lecturing and telling people and having a dead advert, we wanted it to be the catalyst or the seed for the conversation, so that when people go on the website, they would start to interact and they would talk to people. They'd follow scientists on Twitter and they'd start to see these people as human, with human pursuits and human failings and human interests, and start to see what makes Shane Bergen mentally passionate about the materials he works with. Why does he find that so interesting? When the average Joe or Josephine might think, that's a little bit weird, because why is he so into it? Would he not just be an accountant? But when Dart of Physics runs in 2015, we hope for it to be joined by a sister campaign on the London Underground, and we're calling it Underground Physics. And we're at the early stages of that project. We're working with the Institute of Physics, who are the professional bodies for physics in the UK and Ireland, to make that happen. And it would be incredible, because millions of people from around the world take the London Underground every day. So it is
it's
an iconic symbol.
It's a global
brand.
Audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we want to reach many people through the London Underground, the Trinity College brand, that will be on our adverts. So having, from their point of view, imagine having Trinity College Dublin stamped all over the London Underground.
Yeah.
That's priceless. So if the Provost is listening, I'd...
That's priceless, Provost.
but that's not why I do it, of course.
Shane, just what drives you to communicate? Because in a sense, we could talk about what drives you to invent and your work in new materials, but It's equally interesting that you're one of maybe a growing number, but it's still a small number of scientists who are driven to actually break the barrier between the non-science body, the public, and the scientists.
Why do I like to communicate? Well, firstly, I find it really enjoyable, and that's first and foremost. So when my mind wanders, or when I'm meant to be doing something else, often I find myself kind of gravitating towards this. The universe pulls me in that direction. And so sometimes I just go with it because I think...
It's destiny.
Well, I don't believe in fate, but...
As a scientist, it's probably unlikely.
But I guess it's just, it's maybe the path of least resistance, to use a more scientific term. I guess when I allow myself to be creative in that space, I feel like I get a better response from the environment around me.
It's a talent and a skill, and in achieving that result and communicating, which is a bit like teaching on a broader scale, it obviously makes you feel good.
Well, I love to teach, and it's an aspect of my job that I really, really enjoy. And I see it too as somewhere where I can do research and be creative. I think there's a perception out there that when you come to university, all of that rote learning that you would have used in school goes out the window. And now it's all these high intellectual pursuits. I don't think that's true. I think that universities are as guilty as second level schools for rote learning. And so I wanted to explore ways to move away from that so that a physicist who goes through a degree or an engineer in Trinity College will come out with critical skills, creative skills. And these are all higher levels of learning, as educationists would tell us. The lowest level of learning you can have is just simple recall and then understanding. You should be creating environments where students can be analytical and can be creative.
Getting back to where we started, really, I have to ask the obvious question, what is nanoscience?
Oh, great question. So nanoscience is the study of materials where one or more of their sides is on an atomic scale. Now, what does that mean? If you think of a box, right, or any real object, right, it has a breadth, a width, and a height. Right, so we have called this a three-dimensional object. Imagine a ream of paper that you put into the photocopier. So that has a height, right, and as well as a width and a breadth. If you were able to separate that material, if you're able to pare it down such that it has basically a height that's only maybe an atom or two big, then we'd say that's a nanomaterial. So one of its dimensions is shrunk down to a tiny, tiny scale. And that would render the material incredibly different. Matter behaves very, very differently on an atomic scale than it does on a real big world scale like the scale that you and I live in. And that's interesting from a physics point of view because they behave differently. And so tapping into that difference is what's the secret, what is the secret of nanomaterials?
And it's often at the moment when we're talking about nanoscience or nanotechnology or nanomaterials, that it still feels very futuristic and new, but actually it's been around for quite some time.
Well, yeah, so nanoscience, I guess, it's a result of a huge explosion, a revolution in physics that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century. Physicists kind of thought we'd everything wrapped up. We'd figured out how old the world was, which was a huge problem at the time. And we thought we understood almost more or less everything. We thought we knew of all the unknowns and that we just had, it was a matter of time before we solved them. But then many scientists, or well, one in particular, discovered this world of quantum physics. And this was that things will behave very, very differently when you can get down to an extremely small scale. And at the time, it was completely just out there. It was revolutionary. It was like a complete change in thinking. And it was thought that there wouldn't be any application to this, right? It's like the way we look
science
at CERN
fiction.
Now. Yeah, science fiction, right? The Higgs boson sort of level of distance from the regular man and woman. But since then, scientists have been able to start to exploit properties on the quantum and nanoscale. And in the 50s, the great Richard Feynman said, there's plenty of room at the bottom. And that was referring to the fact that there's plenty of interesting physics for us to understand and quantify for materials that are very, very small. And then I guess in the 80s and 90s, a huge number of nanomaterials started to be discovered. Things like the bookie ball, which looks like a football, or the carbon nanotube, which is made from carbon, like diamond or graphite, except it's made in cylinders where its diameter is only a couple of atoms wide, but its length is quite appreciable. So it's, you know, maybe it can be up to a millimeter long, which is very, very big relative to a couple of atoms wide. And so materials like that revolutionized nanoscience. And then famously, in the early 2000s, a material called graphene was discovered. Now, graphene is a two-dimensional material. That means it has no appreciable height. It's only an atom tall. So it's like a deck of cards being graphite. You separate out one, which is one sheet of one card from the deck of cards, and that's your graphene. And the Nobel Prize was awarded to the two scientists that discovered it, and they did it using sellotape and graphite, which is the stuff in pencils. And so they peeled off these layers. From the graphite to get down to something that was one atom thick. And it was amazing because scientists thought before that a material in this configuration with something that has no real height, that it couldn't exist, it would just roll up, that nature wouldn't like it. But they isolated it, they found it. And it is the strongest, most thermally conducting, it has so many superlatives, material that's ever been discovered.
Yeah,
it's extremely light as well. What's special about things like graphene or carbon nanotubes is they offer perhaps more. They are, I imagine, going to be used for things that we can't even think of today. So
that science fiction probably thinks of more laterally for us.
Absolutely. So a lot of what nanoscience has done to date has been fixing existing problems, right? So you think of a smartphone battery or a smartphone screen. These are areas that are demanding from a material point of view and a lifetime point of view, as anyone who's dropped one knows.
Yep.
So making them that are tougher, a battery that can last longer, that's all things that nanomaterials can do. However, they're solving existing problems, right? So what really will be the huge leap is when somebody thinks of an application of one of these nanomaterials that has never been thought of before, right? So I'm talking about the invention of something like a new laser or something like that, you know, something of that level of kind of newness. And when it's discovered first, I guarantee you, nobody will know what to do with it for about 10 years.
And we'll probably dismiss it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we have done with so many inventions or so many leaps.
How do you approach that with your students to actually get them to say that even though the ground may seem fixed and things that we now take as being very solid pieces of science, things could change?
I guess there are two sorts of advances in science. Well, there are three. There are ones that are incorrect, firstly, right? And they'll be proven very quickly to be incorrect by the lack of evidence. There are those that are incremental, and that's the majority of science. So it's, I think science headlines every week should be group of scientists make gradual improvement to existing theory. And that would be great because that's what we should all do. Little another brick in the wall. But occasionally then you do get these radical changes and they often take a while to be accepted. And the way they're accepted by the scientific community is through experiment and through evidence. And that's what we try to get our students to look for. So in the undergraduate labs that I teach, I would ask students to maybe demonstrate a phenomena or maybe calculate something. And at the beginning of the year, they'll find it difficult to distinguish between sort of things that they think they know and things that they think I want them to find. And so I'm like, no, imagine that I'm a complete novice, that I've just arrived from Mars and you have to produce evidence to convince
me
that you're right. So it could be something as simple as when you drop an apple from your hand, you know it falls to the ground and you know why that happens, right? And you, even if you don't understand it, you'll intuitively know if I let go of the apple, it'll fall, right? Now, why does that happen? Well, it's because gravity is acting on it and there are forces between these two objects. But trying to get the student to think, okay, I need to move away from just assuming that people know things and taking things as given. Rather, I need to construct an experiment that will demonstrate what that phenomena is and measure things associated with it such that I can convince this fictional Martian that I'm right.
That extends into so much of life, the idea that we assume things coming from a journalistic background or even within an environment of creating any narrative. Like we always say in our office, the invisible ink says, assume nothing.
Mm.
Because in many ways, we're geared to walk in and make those assumptions as human beings psychologically. We meet people, we make assumptions, we see something happen, we start to construct an assumption. And then the second part you were saying, which is also then we predict what somebody might want to hear. And that bit in the middle of actually figuring out what is provable, which may not be the popular answer, but it also may contradict the assumption, can be where people can become real outsiders.
There is a school of thought that say it's not found until you tell people, right? So people have invented things in the past that get no credit for them because they didn't tell the world. This goes right back to the beginning of modern science, where people like Newton and Leibniz argued over who invented a form of maths called calculus. And it's all about who said it first, right? So that's a huge element there. So if you're being a contrarian stuck in the middle in your scenario there, it's up to you to find evidence to win people over. But it's also up to you to actively listen. And I use that word active deliberately. So it's not that you would listen to someone just wanting to pick out what you want to pick out, but rather that you will go through the process of really being receptive to hearing what they have to say. And scientists are good at that. Scientists go to conferences and we write to each other through journals and letters, basically to find out and to listen to what we've each discovered. And we put that in the context of what we think we know. And then as a community, we move forward.
It's interesting because in many ways, our approach to science, discovery and invention is not a communal one. It's an individual one, which often can be that falsehood around it is who invented the light bulb. So we're supposed to come up with this answer that one person did.
Probably because of ego.
Yeah, and maybe because it's niche. So the Nobel Prize can go to one person. Hmm. And usually it's a whole team. And often it's the person who's left off the list who maybe contributed something key. So there is often that conflict between how we as human beings approach invention, discovery, that this individual has this light bulb moment. The apple falls from the tree and Newton thinks
might be a very Western way of looking at it, where we think of this individual genius, right? But genius is something I don't really subscribe to. I think like
you can,
not so much. I think like we all have different strengths, and maybe your strength might be the kernel of a good idea at the beginning, but my strength might be how to take that and actually make it happen, right? And that person is equally genius. And so it would be for the person who can take that result that the team found and bring it and explain it and contextualize it. I think there are many, many links in the chain there, and they're all important. And I think that idea of the individual lone nutter scientist probably stems from the day when science was the pursuit of sort of, you know, rich people with a lot of time. And science isn't so much like that anymore. I know that the Nobel Prizes are still awarded to individuals, but I kind of think the Nobel Prize is a bit of an aberration. Like, it's science is done by teams. Like, papers are written by groups of people. We do give credit to the first or last author on these papers because they maybe came up with the idea or did the work. But it is always a communal pursuit.
And of course, individuals do matter. From your perspective, when you were that child, that teenager, that student, who inspired you?
I think it was a lot of people. I think it was local first and foremost. My family were always encouraging, brothers and parents and grandparents, of us learning things and us exploring. I think then in school, certain teachers would have had a huge influence on me to pursue what I liked and pursue what I was good at. But it's like, you know, I went to a very ordinary school and I was in a class with everybody from all sorts of people from my town. And I look back now and in my class, so many of us did so well and we're all doing so many different things. I think that's
great. And
what
do you think that is?
I think it was the bunch that I was in school with were particularly, we sparked off each other a lot, and that was great. Academically, from a sporting point of view, from debating, from music, all of these things, we seemed to be pretty good at these things because we all drove each other. But I think that must have been encouraged by the environment set up by the school and by the teachers. But there were particular teachers that I can imagine now, and I think back of as a good teacher. They stick in my head. So my maths teacher, my physics teacher, and it's amazing that they're the things I ended up doing. My music teacher was a big influence too, and so I still have an interest there.
I think the power of one good teacher, of one good lecturer, is incredible. So being a teacher and turning into that as being something that you're good at, clearly, but also that you get such reward from, is quite significant.
Yeah, I love working with young people, and particularly people, the students that I teach and work with in Trinity College. They're amazing. They're great. They're all achievers. They've all done very well in secondary school to get into university. And many of them that I meet there, you can just see they're going to go on to be excellent members of society. They're going to do amazingly disparate things, and many of them will go off into the world and contribute far, far away from Ireland. And that's great. We should be sending people away as ambassadors for our culture and society. And they'll come back. Or if they don't, it doesn't matter. They'll be ambassadors for us when they're away.
But Shane, I think that's really significant, because I know from talking to academics or having a little small footprint around universities for a long time is that when you talk to people involved in research, they will often say, oh, I have to put in so many hours teaching and it's kind of a chore and I just want to be doing my own work. I very rarely hear that, where people embrace both the research and the original work with the fact that you've an opportunity to inspire a generation.
I have to say, and this is maybe controversial, if you don't like students, you shouldn't be working in a university. Like, that's what it's about. Right? Research is huge, and of course you're focused, but all your research will be done with students. They might be postgraduate students, but you'll be working with young people the whole time. And so I know people that would think like that too. And I was just thinking as I was walking into work the other day, why do they do it? Like, they could do anything else.
A big part of how we think about science is about education.
Absolutely.
And
to me, they're all wrapped up.
If it's all about research and outcomes, we miss the point that somewhere along the line, it has to be about actually getting a sense that the baseline is strong. Like, I mean, I think the main thing is that you really need really good primary teachers.
Absolutely. And if a primary and secondary school teachers or just people going into society, we've no member of the Oireachtas that I can think of who has a background in science, maths, engineering or technology. So how can we expect a government to make smart decisions about those things which they themselves say are a driver for an economy if they don't have a background in it? They're relying on people to tell them things as opposed to having an intuitive understanding of that themselves. If our teachers, who are the ambassadors and who are the creators of the next generation of young scientists and engineers, if they themselves have a very limited education and science from their experience in university, or maybe a negative experience of university science, then how can we expect them to be the force of change for children? So it's really important that we look at the way we educate in university. And that's an active area of research for me. And it's something that I've only recently started to do, but I really enjoy it. And I like it because I get to work with people in the humanities. I get to work with social scientists. I work with a professor in the School of Education, Colette Murphy. And the two of us have our backgrounds in science, but we have a very strong interest in how we educate. And so we conduct research on the way that we teach and learn physics and engineering in college. We're having an influence. We're changing things, and it's for the better, I hope.
Just to stick with the point of policy, what is your dream in that? In a kind of a society which had a more informed, more literate approach to science, and where there might be a connection into policy?
My dream or my goal would be that people in a pub or people around a dinner table or at a family meal or whatever, any sort of social situation, that they would be as likely to talk about something that happened in the science world as in the sports world or in the politics world. And so that people feel they can have an opinion in it. And at the moment, I think that people who are not scientists would feel, oh my God, I wouldn't open my mouth about that because I'd probably be wrong and I'll only expose myself as being a bit of a fool on it. And I think that's really unfortunate, because I just wish people would talk about it. And like, obviously you'd like if they were talking about it in an informed way, but just like if I start talking about sport, the amount of stuff I don't know is huge, right? I haven't a clue about it. But yes, I'd have an opinion when the World Cup comes on, right? Because it's topical. So I'd like science to be topical every so often, because there are a huge number of issues in our society that will be solved or will be influenced by science.
So all opinions aren't equal. And I suppose one of the things which is coming, as you say, from literacy, and we see it in the discussion around climate change, in that when you get into an environment where everybody has a sense of the validity of their opinion is, and they've removed from that structure you've said where there has to be some proof, it's anything goes.
I know, it's really unfortunate. And there again is something that we could do through education, so that people don't see science as a body of fact, but they see it as a process. And this is critical. So it's going back to those first year students in the lab, that they will go through a process to build evidence or to gather evidence and then present it. and that their argument stands or falls on the evidence that and the experiments that they have conducted or are found. And so we must look at things like homeopathy and climate change and very things that are seen as controversial in the public discourse in that light.
In terms of finding a proof around our assumptions.
Absolutely. And that's the common thing about, you know, you hear areas like homeopathy that scientists will say, look.
You kind of hate homeopathy.
I do, yeah. because, you know, it's, I think that there's no evidence ever put forward for this that's believable, right? And if any, like they all say, oh yeah, well, you're just biased or whatever. You know, science doesn't know everything. Well, science knows it doesn't know everything, but it has a method to test it. And when we test these pseudosciences using the scientific process, they don't work. And so what the people who defend them will say is, well, your process is flawed. And you're like, really, you know?
So Shane, I get the whole scientific need for proof when we look at things like homeopathy. But then you see the conflict between science, say, and faith-based religion. And you have scientists like Richard Dawkins or Stephen Hawking coming out very publicly against the idea that there is any correlation or any ability to have a belief in God in a science-based world.
Well, Richard Dawkins is interesting, you mentioned him. I think Richard Dawkins does himself no good service. He's way too evangelical. I just get the impression, I don't know the man, I get the impression that he would find it hard to accept evidence that disproves something that he believed in, right? Now, that's just my own belief. But, you know, you have to be careful doing
from
that
your perspective,
as a scientist.
Is there room for God or a God-based faith and science?
I don't know, and I don't want to say that I have a scientific opinion about religion because I don't know anything about it. I've no evidence to say one way or the other.
You mentioned music and the fact that your music teacher was perhaps as influential on you as your maths and physics teacher. I have been told that you have, and the quote was, the voice of an angel. So,
who told you that?
I'm not revealing my sources in the best journalistic tradition. But you sing, you perform.
Well, I perform locally. So I'm in a School of Physics ukulele band now.
A ukulele band.
Yeah. Gosh, that's so obscure, isn't it? Not only are we all physicists, but we all play the ukulele. So myself and my colleague Stefan Hutzler, Matthias Mubius, both have better names than I do, we play as the normal modes, which is funny if you're a physicist, I think. But we only play really at local events in the school, maybe somebody having a significant event in their career, like a promotion or a retirement or something like that.
So on commission.
On commission, solely. Yeah. And Stefan, I guess, would be he's sort of our de facto leader. He has taken some well-known songs and rewritten them with a physics twist. But our music, not only is it ukulele and we're all physicists, but we tend to play kind of old music. And the reason is our very first gig was an Edwardian party, right? Now that sounds odd, but the building that I work in was built in the Edwardian era, which is between 1901 and 1910 when King Edward was king, I guess. And so we had a party to mark the 100th anniversary of our building. And somebody decided, just for the heck of it, let's set it in that area. Now, it's very, people go, but that's so random. But like, you know, there are 1920s is very popular at the moment. So that was our second party. So at the moment,
so
our music is.
What did you play then?
Well, we played, what did we play the first year? We played things like Daisy Bell, you know, that song,
great.
Which actually goes right back to my early days. Yeah. It was I think it was one of the first songs that I ever learned that my granny taught me in the kitchen. We were baking and So we play loads of music like Marlene Dietrich's music.
And you're going to give us a little bit of a showcase, I think.
Well, you have asked me to, and so I reluctantly brought it along.
Oh my goodness, you have a ukulele with you.
There is something over there that I have a very cool looking ukulele case.
But before you entertain us, I'm really curious about how the ukulele came about. I mean, when did you start playing it? Why the ukulele?
Well, after my PhD, I went to London for 3 years to work as a scientist in Imperial College. And it was a fantastic experience, a fantastic life experience moving away for a few years. It's something I would encourage people to do. It makes you look at home in a different way, a positive way, but it also makes you think broadly about where you're, who you are and what you do in the world. And I know everyone doesn't have that experience, but if you can do it, do it. And when I was over there, I met amazing people. I moved in with randomers just through the internet. That's the way London is.
Was it like the Big Bang?
No, they're not scientists. So all my London friends are
so
not
it's like
scientists.
It's,
yeah, absolutely. And I like your laugh at that differential. Don't start me on the Big Bang Theory. But I hate that program. But I moved in with randomers who are now some of my best friends. And when I was 30 and living in London, they bought me a ukulele.
Why?
I don't know. I think, God, why did they buy me a ukulele?
You just had ukulele written all over you.
Yeah, maybe they knew. And I think I should point out that I bought a ukulele, or it was given to me before it was trendy. Now you see a lot of people in London playing the ukulele. It's very, very trendy to do it now. Maybe it's because it's small and, you know, it's easy to get it around.
It's easy to carry on the aforementioned underground.
Yeah, and you look like a bit of a gangster going around with a hard case, ukulele case like that, you know.
So what are you going to play?
I think I'll have to play Daisy for you then.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Absolutely. I'll just do a chorus of it. I should tune
so,
this.
I have to say it is small, very small and perfectly formed.
You're talking about the ukulele.
I am talking about the ukulele. You started with guitar.
Mm.
And you're a music teacher.
So yeah, when in primary school, we didn't do much music. I went to an all-boys primary school, so music and art and all those things were just out the window, right? And when I got to secondary school then, I had a music teacher and she had just started. And my friends, we just all, just luck or whatever, there was a load of us that were into music. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was easily my favourite class in the week, going to music. And
and what was her name?
Anya Loughran. And
Anya, if you're there, you made a difference.
And I did the school shows and that gave me great confidence in speaking and talking and being in front of large groups of people. So all these things are so important. And then
she really helped you become the communicator you are.
Oh, absolutely. Her and my debating teacher, I think, were a huge influence in developing those talents and skills. And when I was in third year or fourth year, a bunch of friends and I, we formed like a, you know, high school band. Yeah. And we were
like
rubbish.
You too.
We played mainly REM covers. And my friend Owen King wrote a number of songs as well.
I love REM.
Yeah, we did a lot of that stuff. And I was in local music groups and things. And it was a way to socialize with people, as I didn't do sport. And when you grow up in the country, if you don't do sport, unless you can find something like music or that, well, you're going to be one of those kids that does nothing. And I just had to do something.
And you love to sing. It makes you feel good, right?
Yeah, I do. And I play music at home, particularly if I'm on my own, or I had one flatmate who used to sing with me, and that was always nice. My
one flatmates. Of the randomers.
Yeah, Smitha in London, who I used to sing with.
I think I'm going to create a series called The Randomers. There just has to be something called
The Randomers. Yeah. God, those two randomers that I moved in with, like, they're two of my closest friends. I see them all the time now. And that was just so random. I just moved to London and I had a big, long list of flats that I had to go and see. And they were one of the few flats that had no pictures on the internet. And I wasn't sure about going to see it. And when I went to see it, it just, you know, like, I guess it's sort of like friendship at first sight.
So, Daisy Bell?
Yeah. Do you want to hear that then?
Very much so.
It's early now, so we have to forgive me. Let's sit out of tune. Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford the carriage. Won't you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two?
Woo!
Maybe I'll try that in a higher key. Which Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, doom. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage, I can't afford the carriage. Won't you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two?
Woohoo!
God, it brings me back, because I sang that with my granny when I was like four, I think, in the kitchen. And it was just the song she taught me. And then it came back in college when we were doing that thing with our group. And my good friend and colleague, Dennis Weir, who's a retired professor and a great influence, I think, on my career now, he came into my office one day and had found original sheet music of Daisy Bell that he'd found at an auction and bought it for me. Isn't that nice? I have it up in my office now.
Oh, it's lovely. Yeah, because it was a really popular song between America and here.
Was it? Okay. Yeah. And people, because there wasn't the prevalence of technology to play back music then, people sang a lot more then. So there would have been the sense of people singing in groups, like, you know, that my dad always asked me when I go to parties, did you have a sing song? I'm like, I don't know where he thinks we go, but, well, sometimes we do. But I think looking back, that was much more of a big deal. And so people had these repertoires of songs, and people were perhaps better musicians back then because they would have had to play if they wanted to hear music, and people could sing by looking at musical notation.
It's a loss, really, because a lot of people now don't have that. They would feel very uncomfortable singing a song, and what song would it? But in a sense, I'm not the best either, but everybody in my family, when you're growing up, your uncles, your aunties, your parents, they all had their song or songs, and no gathering was complete until they all did.
And it had to go in the same order.
Yes.
And you couldn't sing your Auntie Eileen's song, or
sing
your Uncle Shane's song. You just had to sing. You sang your song. And my granny on my mother's side, actually, she had over 30 grandchildren. She had 12 children. So my mum's one of 12. So when we'd have family gatherings,
that's a lot of songs.
Yeah, a lot of songs, but they are all quite musical, that family. So we had great sing songs as kids. See, and so we were all made to perform.
I think what's great about music and that marriage between what you're doing is it's probably also just a fun relief as well, that it's something that gives you a switch off and a way to enjoy.
It's not mindless, it's mindful. So when you're playing music, your mind, or my mind at least, is completely taken up by that task. And I think cooking is similar, or even helping my dad in his expansive garden. It's just that sense of task that doesn't take up a huge amount of mental skill, but it just fills your mind with the task. Do you know what I mean? You know the sense of blackberry picking and Seamus Heaney's poem about it, when you have this sense of just going out and doing it, it's the process of it, and you get absorbed into it. So playing music is like that. It's a rhythm, exactly.
It's like running. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
In a sense, your brain can be actively doing whatever it wants. It's great. So Lego, cooking, ukulele, they're all paths to defining the universe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just about not being afraid to just have a go and pursue the things that you both like and you feel that you have some ability in. Like, and I certainly know the things that I don't feel confident in, and I just don't do them, which is probably awful.
And what are they?
Sport would be the one that I think I could just hand that mantle over to my middle brother, who's the family sports star. But it doesn't do anything for me. Like, I like watching the rugby, or when there's a sense of national pride about something, that's great. I get sucked in by that. I'd be, you know, a soccer fan once every 4 years when the World Cup is on.
So I asked you who inspired you, but maybe the other way to think about it now is, who do you admire?
That's a very good question. I guess I have to think about that one. Who do I admire? Well, I admire people who believe in their convictions. I admire colleagues who have done their own thing and dared to be a little bit different. People like Mary Robinson would be somebody who I greatly admire, or our president, Michael D. Higgins. I'm a liberal person, and I think Ireland is a conservative country with a lot of liberal people living in it. Often those people don't have a strong representation or voice. But occasionally we produce these amazingly broad thinking people like Seamus Heaney or Mary Robinson or our president. And I think that that's to be admired all the more for the reason that these people would have been forming their opinions and careers at a time when the Catholic Church and political culture would have had a stranglehold over the way we thought.
And when they were often the outsiders.
Absolutely.
And had to battle, in that Noel Brown analogy of swimming against the tide. So, and people like Robinson or Heaney or Michael D, you have that sense that they are all intellectual, beyond maybe what you're admiring is a political approach.
Yeah, I think I definitely have a political view on things, all right. I suppose my friends would know what it is, but I wouldn't ever express it professionally, which is, I don't know why I don't do that.
But you also picked out two poets there. So poetry perhaps is also something in your realm.
Yeah, I have a colleague who's a physicist and a poet, the great Iggy McGovern. So we hear a lot of it in work, and that's very nice. But again, it goes back to school. I remember learning and thinking of poems when I was in junior cycle English class, and they really connect with you from time to time, you know.
And poetry is often a compacted sentence so that you unpack it as you grow older.
Yeah, just a phrase and how it can linger in your head like for a long time, and it just resonates with you time and time again.
And Heaney, no more than many poets, gave us a language for our time, that in some ways he allowed us to articulate what was happening in our culture, in our country. And sometimes that's what those thinkers, you're saying you don't really go with genius, but in a sense, those original thinkers allow us to enter into a narrative, allow us a way to talk about where we're from and who we are.
Yeah, and he famously said, and I resonate with it, between my finger and my thumb, the squab pen rests, I'll dig with it. And I remember thinking, God, I really identified with that as I was pursuing things intellectually and through learning, and that I thought, that's how I'm digging, that's how I'm contributing and finding.
And finding truths, because that really is about what he's getting at, is that he's excavating. And, and it's very powerful, because it made many of us feel that we could connect in a different way, as he did with his forefathers, that it didn't have to be manual. All of us have some way that we're digging.
Yeah, but yet he admired and respected both his father and grandfather in that poem. And I thought that was really important, because he knew where he had come from and what had formed him to get to that point where he's doing his work.
And you've referenced that as well with your grandmother, and even with that song, Daisy Bell. I mean, someone like your granny clearly had an impact on you.
Yeah, and I'm lucky that I have two grandparents that are still alive, and they're in their 90s.
That's fantastic.
Well, my grandfather's in his 90s and his mind is as fresh. So, yeah, they're still a huge influence on me, and it's wonderful to grow up with grandparents. They were right across the river from where I went to school, and so I went and had lunch with them every day with my brothers and cousins. And Nanny made us dinner every day, and that's great. Like, I'm so lucky to have had that.
It's like a fairy story.
Yeah, I guess it is. Like, in the laughs we would have had with them and the time that they would have had to spend with us as we grew up, I think I'm just lucky, you know? That's probably it.
We were talking about where you might want to go and who you might admire now. Probably there's also an ability to look at what, at this stage, you might see has been the thing that you're proudest of, that you've done, your achievement. I mean, if you were to pick out something that you think, yeah, kind of nailed that, I'm glad I did that.
I'm proud of achievements like the friendships I've made with people and the breadth of people that I've gotten to know and the life experiences that I've enjoyed. I'm proud that I opened myself to that and that I went out into the world. That's, I think, what I'm proud of. But on a sort of in a material sense or in a project sense, I'm very proud of the work I've done in communicating science, specifically the DART of Physics project. I really feel like that was great. And it went from just being an idea that I had when writing physics lectures in my parents' conservatory, having just moved home from England and being really sad about that, to something that really is central to my career and something that has allowed me to meet and work with amazing people. And I'm proud of any student who comes and talks to me about a positive influence that I've had on their learning or their careers.
I was kind of expecting that, because I think for a teacher who likes teaching and who has that impact, it must be amazing when you see the student coming back, even already after a year or so, and saying, you made a difference in my life.
Yeah, it can be little things, just like listening to somebody who's having a hard time, maybe as a PhD student, something isn't going right for them with their supervisor, and that you just have a coffee with them and you give them the chance to vent and then maybe try as best you can to offer some advice as to how they might get out of it. And you think, oh, that was only half an hour of your time, but maybe that issue is keeping them awake for nights, and you just try and remember times in your own career, in your own studies, that you struggled with something. And I think if you can put yourself in the shoes of that student, it motivates you to help.
Dr. Shane Bergen, ukulele playing cook, teacher and physicist, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.